Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, Animal Rights, BARC, Bristol Animal Rights Collective, with Joe Thomas, who's a hunt saboteur, and Caroline. Plus our weekly news with Jason Yannakopoulos and a look at Ecoville 2000 again. And we start this week with Bristol Animal Rights Collective. Hello, Caroline. Hello, Joe, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Thanks for inviting us.
Now, first of all, Caroline, what's the latest? Because I know you've got a film on next week, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. It's next Wednesday night, the 28th of August. It's at Cafe Kino, which is on Stokes Croft. And the film's called Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home. And it's an absolutely brilliant film. It's about people that farmed animals or used to farm animals, and they develop a really close bond with the animals, and they've developed such a strong bond they decide actually they don't want to do farming anymore. It's really emotional actually, because you really get to feel in a way sort of really empathise with the way that they're feeling.
But surely for farmers, you really shouldn't and can't do that, because at the end of the day, as soon as they're big enough, they go into the truck and off to the abattoir.
And I think that's what they realised. Yeah, they start to realise that actually these animals aren't commodities anymore. So in farming, animals are very much seen as commodities most of the time.
Well,
these were quite exceptional farmers that sort of saw beyond that.
Well, it's a strange thing, eating meat, because it's the difference between the actual animal in the field, which we all know and love, and then the sort of slab of meat on a polystyrene bit of stuff you see in a supermarket. Look,
people are often quite detached from that, aren't they?
Well, I know. And can you just give us an idea of what really does go on between the two? Because this is one of the things I love about animal rights people, is they're not afraid to think and talk about this. And for much of the rest of our society, this is something which is almost taboo.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I think we often think it's okay to treat dogs quite differently, for example, to how we might imagine we'd treat pigs or cows. And actually, pigs and cows are as intelligent as dogs. You'd be really surprised. So, for example, with if we're talking about chicken meat, just as an example, chickens are usually killed within 6 weeks, and they'd normally live for at least 18 months naturally, probably more than that. So chickens would be raised for almost all their life. Even with free-range farming, they'd be inside for most of their life. And with factory farming, they would certainly be inside for their whole life. They'll be kept in sheds where there'll be six chickens in the size of a microwave oven. So it's a bit like us and five of our friends in a telephone box not being able to move. And they're like that for their whole life. They're fed high-protein diets and given antibiotics and hormones. And they're given hormones and high-protein diet to make them grow faster, and antibiotics to try and stop them making each other sick. Now, so it's really unnatural.
Now, hormones particularly worry me. I mean, anything that's being pumped into these poor baby chicks, because you're then eating that chicken that's been pumped with these hormones. Now, do you know anything about the effects that that might have on people eating
that
chicken?
Well, I'd imagine it's pretty terrible, actually, if it's getting into people's bodies. I'd imagine that's pretty bad.
I mean, growth hormone in a human body, I imagine, is going to have some sort of similar effect. It's difficult to know these things, but certainly pumping them full of hormones. I mean, why do they do this?
To make them grow faster. So the faster you can make a chicken grow, the faster you can kill it and eat it. So they're being treated like commodities. And the other thing they do is de-beak chickens when they're young as well, to stop them from pecking each other, because they're kept in such close confinement that actually chop the beaks off. It's just incredible.
Now,
and they do that without any anaesthetics. So it's like us having heart. And they've got pain receptors there, so they can feel that. It's really uncomfortable.
Now, you mentioned briefly this whole thing of free-range chickens that never actually see daylight.
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? If you buy something that's free range, you think that the thing, the poor little creature, at least has had a chance to run around outside.
So, that's right. So they can be in a barn, and the barn will have an exit, so they can go out, but quite often they're not able to get out.
What do you mean they're not able to?
Well, the barns don't have windows, so quite often they can't find their way to the exit. So they quite often can't even find their way out of the exit.
Now, have you yourself actually ever been to look at, you know, conditions of
the animals? I have seen quite a lot of undercover footage. So there's some organisations like Animal Aid and Viva who do quite a lot of undercover investigations, and they're quite shocking when you look at them. And this actually includes RSPCA Freedom Farm stamped food as well. So some of the RSPCA approved farms are still very terrible.
Well, we've heard some bad stuff about the RSPCA recently, and particularly going in and prosecuting people who are running animal sanctuaries, which seems a little bit harsh. What's your thoughts about them?
Well, I think they can be quite dodgy, actually, the RSPCA, if I'm totally honest. I think it's fair to say they have done some good work around saving, you know, they do some good work, but they also do things like stamping food. Some of these farms that they stamp say it's okay to, you know, sort of promoting meat is obviously a really bad thing. I think with some of the they also have cats and dogs homes, and they have been known to kill animals as well in their own sort of cats and dogs homes, so which you know, in dodgy circumstances. There's probably all sorts of examples, actually, that people have got of the RSPCA.
Well, Radio 4 recently did a Face the Facts about the RSPCA national television.
Interesting.
National Radio, yeah. Radio 4. they were saying, for example, that certain people who are running animal sanctuaries, even just informal ones, the RSPC were doing dawn raids on them, and then many of the animals actually in those sanctuaries were being killed.
Yeah, whereas you'd like to hope that people would be supported rather than raided by the RSPCA.
And that they have quite a lot of police powers.
Pretty
that they've
shocking,
sort of taken on
it?
Themselves. Very good on the law, so they realise effectively some RSPCA people being kind of like almost having the power of citizen's arrest, but having a uniform, an RSPCA peaked cap, and using that to arrest people who are running animal sanctuaries doesn't really seem to me to be what most people that fund and give donations to the RSPCA would want.
No, it's not what people would expect, really, is it? No.
Anyway,
back
to your film.
Yeah.
What is it that actually makes a farmer turn almost native with the animals, and rather than sort of cut off emotionally from those animals and see them off to market to make a living, start saying, well, actually, these animals, I've got some sort of emotional attachment? Because it seems strange maybe to make an emotional attachment with a cow, for example.
Yeah. Well, there was a few examples. There was a man who grew up on a farm, and he took, as a teenager, he used to go to the market with cows. And one time he just went and he just found that he was beside himself and he was in hysterics crying. And he just couldn't bear the thought of selling this cow that was going to go off for slaughter. And the same man actually was in, and I think it was just before this, he was in the field and a cow just came and put his head on his chest and just sort of rubbed up to him. And I think at that point this cow was trying to sort of develop a bond with him, and he just really sort of softened, I suppose, and thought, actually, this cow has some emotion towards me. And then he felt some emotion towards the animal. So I think part of it was sort of picking up on the emotions that the animals had, and then kind of having feeling some emotion towards them. There was a couple that were farming goats, and they were trying to find, it was almost like wanting to have their cake and eat it. They didn't send the goats off to slaughter, but they were actually selling them to people to have as pets, trying to tell themselves that people were actually going to keep them in their back gardens, but they realised actually that it wasn't the case, and people were breeding the goats and then selling the young off for meat. So I think there's a sort of case of some people trying to almost pretend that they weren't actually involved in the killing process, but then there's also examples of where the animals actually came up and showed an emotion to the people, and they sort of had a response back to that.
Well, I've had a little bit of experience living on a farm in my youth, and can remember the strange attitude of sheep, particularly in that they seem to take on, a bit like humans, take on the approaches and the behaviour of the people around them. And we had one particular sheep who had somehow become entangled in the field. And I actually went over and freed the sheep.
Oh, well done.
And it completely changed its character. It would look at all the other sheep and say, what are you doing running away from these humans? They're actually quite friendly. And in fact, whenever I arrived back walking down past the field, this particular sheep would come over and run down the field on the inside of the fence, where I was walking on the outside of the fence, waiting for me at the end. You know, they obviously, I mean, obviously you wanted something to eat, you know, you wanted a few little nibbles or whatever. I mean, there is this element in human behaviour, which I think is great that you picked up on this, is that farmers behave in that particular way to get the meat. But ultimately, we need meat to survive as humans. You know, we're designed to eat meat, aren't we?
No, we're not. We don't need to have meat. I mean, I know people who have got vegan children who are now strapping 18-year-olds who live really healthily without meat. In fact, without meat, dairy or eggs. Parts of Asia where they don't hardly have any animal products, if any animal products, and people live really healthily. We certainly don't need meat in our diet. You can live really healthily on a veggie or vegan diet.
With lots of nuts, things like that for protein, is that it?
Other sources of protein include wholemeal bread, brown rice, lentils, beans are really good, tofu, quinoa is a really good source of protein. And in fact, often in the West, we're eating too much protein. We don't need to have as much as we're having.
Now,
studies show that veggies and vegans have just as high level of protein, iron and calcium as people who eat meat.
Right, well, that's good news. We're also joined by Joe Thomas. Hi, Joe.
Hiya.
Now, you are a hunt saboteur.
Indeed.
Tell us why.
I think it started in my teens, just wanting to put an end to animal suffering, certainly, and getting involved with animal rights and not really seeing immediate results. There were certainly results that came in the long run, but I think the reason I got into hunt sabotage was you can go out on that day and save an animal's life. It's as simple as that. It's an amazing thing to be able to do. It's not a very nice thing to do. It's certainly, you know, very confrontational from time to time with hunters, but in the long run, to be able to go out on a hunt sab and be able to see direct results is just absolutely outstanding.
But what about, surely foxes, vermin? I mean, you know, they are actually a pest.
I mean, many do see them that way, which is a sad state of the times. But, you know, certainly myself and the people around me that I associate myself with see them as beautiful creatures. You know, just last night, actually, I was sat at Brandon Hill in Bristol and watched a family playing for hours and hours, a family of foxes, two young fox cubs, and it was just a stark reminder that this month, you know, at the same time that I'm watching these fox cubs, the hunts are now planning to start cub hunting. Certain hunts within the country have already started, and what that means is training hounds to get a taste of blood by chasing baby foxes to their deaths.
But we've had occasions where foxes have actually attacked humans and attacked children. I mean, I think I'm talking about one a few months ago, an occasion where a fox managed to get in through a cat flap or something and actually get into a child's bedroom and attacked the child.
There certainly have been, you know, stories of that in the press, and I think they are massively fabricated. Certainly, it always seems to come at a time when the hunting seasons are about to come around again. And even if those attacks did happen, and I'm not, you know, sort of saying that they're, I'm not trying to stand out in defence of them in any way whatsoever, but what I'm trying to say is, you know, we have to see what other animals have done to babies in the past. You know, are we, you know, wanting to, you know, produce a mass slaughter of dogs, for example, when dogs attack babies, but we see them as cute family pets, whereas many people still see foxes as vermin.
Also, the amount of times that people have shot foxes, and that just never gets into the news. So if you think about how many foxes have been attacked by people, for example, that's just never newsworthy.
I'm just looking at an article in the Independent, rare but not unprecedented, Britain's worst fox attacks. I mean, it seems I mean, the actual chance of a child being killed is rare, if ever. But certainly, these are animals who are looking for food. And if there's a vulnerable baby there, it's going to see it as food. And if possible, kill it and drag it back for its young to eat.
Well, these are isolated incidents, and I don't think it's ever gone that far, to be honest with you. But, I mean, certainly, what you have to look at, like I said, these are isolated incidents, and it's in no justification whatsoever why we should be hunting foxes and why we should be seeing foxes as vermin.
And one of the occasions here is talking about a child who actually started to stroke the fox. The fox turned around and bit the child's arm, you know.
Well, the fox was probably scared. You know, these are foxes that aren't used to human interaction.
What about the hunting ban? Surely you're out of a job now. There's been a hunting ban, is there?
I wish. Yeah, I wish I could have my Saturdays back and I could have a nice long lie-in on a Saturday, but sadly it's not to be. Being a hunt saboteur pre-ban and post-ban, there have been no changes. In fact, I was just saying to someone recently that since the ban has come into place, I've only actually seen one hunt using a trail, which is what they're supposed to do.
Okay, so what are they supposed to do? What's the change now?
Well, the change is they're not supposed to be chasing foxes. It's as simple as that. What they're supposed to do is have an artificial trail in place. If they accidentally knock up a fox, which happens to be in a hedgerow, for example, then it's deemed as, well, there's loopholes in the law that say they can get away with that. We've never seen any evidence of this. We're out week in, week out monitoring these fox hunts, and they haven't changed. When the police come out and join us, they don't know what's legal hunting. They don't know what's illegal hunting. So It's a very dodgy issue, and it's a really hard one for us to prove. And we're never believed, both by the police and in the courts, you know. But it's slowly catching on. I mean, there was a case just last year of the Heathrop hunt who were convicted, and it was actually the first conviction of illegal hunting. But it's certainly having a knock-on effect, because since then, more hunts are being exposed for illegal hunting, and hopefully more are brought to justice for it.
Okay, where are our big local hunts around Bristol?
There are a few around Bristol. We've got the Cotswold Vale Hunt, you know, and if you search for them on Google, you'll see all the...
Or another search engine, not necessarily Google, yeah.
Well, absolutely, yeah. All the nasty things that they've got up
to. But where are they based then?
They're based in the Cotswolds, near Gloucester. We have the Ross Harriers, we have the Barclay Hunt. All of these are close to Bristol.
Am I right in thinking that badminton's got a hunt, isn't it? The Duke of Beaufort's, and that's one of the biggest in the country.
Yes, absolutely.
That's just the other side of the M4, isn't it? Off towards Tetbury direction.
That's
of course,
right.
Where Prince Charles and Highgrove is as well. So, and he's what about him? Do you know about his attitude to this? Is he someone who's into fox hunting?
Definitely, yeah. It's a royal pastime, isn't it, to hunt animals? And I think it's absolutely disgusting. Mm. And I'm sure that everyone who believes in the rights of animals, you know, feels exactly the same.
Well, yeah, but I mean, surely you can understand that before we were settled, human beings were hunter-gatherers. Actually, getting food this way was one of the only ways we could survive.
And we've evolved so much since then, haven't we? You know, it's 2013. You know, fox hunting isn't a form of pest control. It's simply just a sport for the rich. It's nothing more than the thrill of the chase of seeing an animal ripped to pieces for fun.
And I've seen some estate managers and people to do with estates actually breeding foxes deliberately so that they can then be hunted.
Absolutely.
So they're not obviously really interested in keeping the population down, keeping it up.
No.
Anyway, let's round off, Caroline, with just a reminder about the film next week, and remind us whereabouts it's on, and about your campaign and where we can find you.
Yeah, so it's Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home, a really inspirational film about people that used to farm animals and then decided not to anymore. It's fantastic, well worth watching. It's Wednesday the 28th of August, which is next Wednesday, at Cafe Kino, and that's in Stokes Croft.
It's just about the junction of Ashley Road and Stokes Croft.
Yes, it is, yeah. And it's a vegan cafe, so it's just downstairs. Doors open at 7:15, film starts at 7:30. It's quite a short film, so it's only an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay, and what about your group? Where can people find you? And I don't know if you've got phone numbers or anything like that. That would be helpful.
Yeah, so it's Bristol Animal Rights Collective. The email is bark@hotmail.co.uk.
And that's BARC.
That's right, at hotmail. bristolanimalrights.co.uk. The website is bristolanimalrights.org.uk.
Okay, can you just also just tell us your phone number?
Yeah, it's 075-81-679-803. Shall I repeat that? It's 075-81-679-803.
So, Joe Thomas and Caroline from BARC, Bristol Animal Rights Collective, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thanks for inviting us.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2, your voice, your choice.
Now I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Now, what we got this week? You're not clutching Private Eye this week. It's a copy of The Eye.
Well, it's a copy of quite a few pages. I think we're going to start with the one you've got in front of you, which is the Daily Mail.
Okay. Now, that is mystery as the new crime unit boss quits after failing security checks. Senior fraud investigator put in charge of fighting financial crime at the new FBI-style police agency will not take up the job after claims that he's failed security vetting. Jeremy Outon, a former partner at KPMG, earning around £580,000 a year, was named as the head of the National Crime Agency's Economic Crime Command in April. But due to the role's highly sensitive nature, he was put through extensive vetting with experts trawling through his financial affairs. Sounds like he's failed the test.
Yes, he claims he hasn't, though, which is very interesting. He worked for KPMG for, do you think, so like £80,000?
£580,000 he was earning.
Oh,
now,
wow. A lot more than what I said.
Let's just take a look at KPMG. Who is this company for which he was a partner? Interestingly enough, a few months ago, one of their partners in the United States was dismissed for selling confidential information on clients of KPMG to for Rolex watches and bags of cash whilst playing golf. So he'd be off playing golf, Rolex watches or bags of cash would swap hands, as would confidential information about KPMG's clients. Now, KPMG is a financial services firm that goes in. Incidentally, Mayor Ferguson has just bought Bristol's KPMG headquarters.
Well, that's an intriguing one then, isn't it?
With a little bit of help from Matthew Payne, who is a volunteer from KPMG, who has managed to twist the mayor's arm and persuade him to buy KPMG's.
You know you want to, really.
That's right. And so that is now going to
house.
Would
you like a Rolex watch?
Is that going to? I'm sure George would not accept that sort of thing.
Of course not.
We've done it again like last week. We're saying the same thing at the same time, Jason. So KPMG are a financial services firm. They've been in the council. They're one of their volunteers because they're so incredibly wealthy and managing to get lots and lots of money off these big banks for auditing their accounts correctly, of course. Now, one of the things that bothers me, Jason, is in 2006, 2007, 2008, KPMG did the accounts for some of the biggest banks in the country. Those accounts proved to be worthless. So why is KPMG, one of their partners, appropriate to run one of these massive new FBI-style financial crime agencies? This one's called the National Crime Agency's Economic Crime Command.
Well, why are they appropriate? The thing is, they're not, really. They're just relying on the fact that, these people must know a lot about finance. We want to deal with financial crime, so we're going to get a lot of people who know a lot about finance.
But the thing is, that what happens when he is investigating KPMG?
Conflict of interest a bit.
I think it might be, mightn't there? And also interesting that he's failed these security checks.
It really does.
This one story shows so much about what is wrong with the way this country's governed. The idea that someone goes straight from a company which could be committed criminal offences, that is to say false accounting or fraud to do with the accounts of the big banks that turned out to be junk accounts, and sign them off, put their number on the dotted line at the bottom, now involved in this policing role, just seems incredible. It's almost like getting Rupert Murdoch to run Ofcom.
I'm sure he'd love that.
Okay, that was the Daily Mail. Not always an annoying newspaper. I'm not that you picked that one out, but
just usually.
All right. You got another story. What paper's this then?
This is Daily Express. It's a really interesting one. We have a teen fraudster who films off business class to luxury destinations worldwide by illegally using the online booking of various travel companies, including the one that he used to work at.
Oh, so this is a bit naughty, isn't it? So he worked for a travel firm, and then he started using their online systems to book himself air tickets.
It was Thompson. He worked them out of £11,000 because when he left, they forgot to cancel his security pass and code. They forgot to change their passwords. So he continued to use their passwords to get into their system to book himself flights to various places.
So what was he doing? Having holidays or what?
Yes, yeah, very much. In one case, he treated two of his friends to a night away at a very posh hotel near Heathrow.
So he didn't actually get on a plane or anything, didn't book flights, just the hotel at Heathrow. That seems a little bit tame.
He says during this time he flew out to Los Angeles, New York, Atlanta, Abu Dhabi and Singapore.
I suppose he was sitting on his phone in the hotel room saying, where do you want to go, guys?
I can imagine that. Here's a good one. He discovered that a representative of a group called Cambridge Business Travel had not logged off a public computer, and by scanning the user's emails, he was able to gain access to that company's booking system to book long-haul flights around the world.
Okay, so he's basically a hacker, isn't he?
Yes.
And now, so what's happened to him? Is he on trial? Has he been convicted or what?
He is in court.
So, yes, the question is, it's an interesting one for the judge and for the jury. Was it the responsibility of his former employers to cancel his account once they sacked him or not? I suppose that will be argued in court.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the court sentence is that his defending lawyer, Jim Laverty, said he knew his client could be jailed, and he claims that Scobie has Asperger's syndrome, which, by the way, is the same as what I've got. I also have Asperger's syndrome, and the sentence was deferred for psychiatric reports. So we'll have to wait and see how that one goes.
Okay, we'll see what happens. I've got a copy of the Journalist magazine. This is for members of the National Union of Journalists, but it's not only available to them. Anyone can subscribe to it. It is fresh BBC strike vote if pay talks break down. Pay talks are due to reopen at the BBC after union members rejected a new offer in a consultative ballot. The corporation was warned there'd be a formal vote on industrial action, including strikes, if Director General Tony Hall failed to produce acceptable proposals at a meeting on the 13th of August. The union was forced to set aside an earlier vote on stoppages after management came forward with marginally improved terms. So what's happened is there's been some sort of strike ballot over pay and conditions of some kind at the BBC, and the management have done a little bit, and so they've had to sort of start the process over again. NUJ Chapel officers told the BBC that a new offer had been rejected and warned the management that members' response had been influenced by disgust of vast executive payoffs and the disastrous failure of the Digital Media Initiative. Did you hear about this Digital Media Initiative that our licence fee payers' money was wasted on?
No.
Anyway, the initiative was designed to make it easier for BBC journalists to handle and share audio and video by using new digital production tools, but it was abandoned at a cost of...
Go for it.
Nearly £100 million.
That's a lot of money.
Former BBC Director General Mark Thompson's due to appear at the Commons Public Accounts Committee in September to be questioned over £25 million, which was paid to 150 outgoing executives. An initial pay offer to union reps from the management amounted to a one-off payment of £600, which was increased to £650, then to £800. The corporation is also keen to consolidate unpredictability allowances into salaries. So what they're trying to do is to say, well, if we call you up in the middle of the night to do some sort of urgent news story, we're not going to pay you any extra.
Well, that's shocking, really.
Because Birch certainly set against this £25 million, which has been paid to the top executives. Quite shocking, really. Anyway, that's a little extract from... Journalist magazine. I mean, the thing is, when we see the BBC criticised, Jason, it's almost obvious that the only person really to gain from that is Murdoch's guy and the Murdoch empire.
Yeah, this is the problem. This is the problem we have is, as far as it goes, the BBC, the person it is, and with the problems they have, it's either them or Murdoch. And to be honest, I'd rather have them.
Okay. Now, there is also, of course, newspapers. We don't just have to get our news from the TV.
Well, we have
in
the
this fast-moving world. Yeah, the Eye is a great little paper, I think. It's 20p, reasonable summary of the week's news. Which one have you picked out today?
Of course, it's practically my story of the week, really. The anti-fracking process. And
oh, this is down Caroline in Balcombe in Sussex, I believe.
Indeed. Caroline Lucas, the Green Party MP, has been arrested for effectively standing up for something she believes in. So I don't know what that says about this country when an MP gets arrested for standing up for something they believe in.
Okay, so why is she doing that, do you think?
Well, because the problem with fracking is it's not particularly safe and it could damage the environment to the point where there's actually been objections even from the RSPB, that's the Royal Society of Protection of Birds. They've objected to fracking in Lancashire and Sussex, arguing regulation will not protect water habitats in these areas.
Well, that's right. One of the main problems with fracking, which isn't mentioned too much in the mainstream press, I think for fear of actually worrying people, is the effect that fracking can have on the water supply. I mean, if you've seen, there's a very interesting video called Fracking Hell, which shows you... in the United States, where this fracking has been going on, they say, oh, it doesn't really affect the water supply. It's at a much lower level. The fracking takes place well below the water table. Actually, they've been getting all sorts of poison and methane and gases, explosive gases, in their water. So if anyone tells you that your water supply is not going to be affected, the fresh water that comes out of the beautiful ground was all a wonderful gift to mankind at one time. The frackers are poisoning our water supplies, Jason.
That is terrible, along with the fact that it could seriously damage the landscape and the environment as a whole. Now, interesting fact where this is taking place, which is, of course, in Balcombe, that is Horsham constituency. Francis Maud is the MP there. It's also the home of Lord Howell, who is George Osborne's father-in-law.
And is also making money out of fracking. Apparently, one of the side effects of the fracking, well, we know it is the use of a massive amount of water, fresh water. So I suppose any area like the Mendips where they start fracking, Jason, will start seeing the price of our water going up too.
No, that is definitely true.
And maybe a permanent hosepipe ban.
Probably, well, Thames Valley area there.
Yeah, but I mean, we've had those bans. Do you remember we had a ban beginning of last year?
It was hilarious
because as soon as they announced the ban, so it started pouring with rain and it didn't stop for about 5 months.
Yeah, that was a great joke even down at Thames Valley where I live. So it's interesting. I think that one of the most important things about this about the fracking, about this story in particular, is Green Party MP Caroline Lucas, she's done something actually quite heroic. She's actually risked arrest. She's gone out there and risked her neck, but her whole career on standing up for something she believes in. And, well, wouldn't it be great if a lot more MPs did that instead of worrying about their expenses and worrying about their paycheck coming through the post?
I think you're right. I mean, you know, the idea of being arrested is a little bit nerve-wracking, but at least she's prepared to go to the line to say, look, I really don't believe in this. And also, the other great thing about Caroline is she's been pointing out some of the financial connections of government people to this as an enterprise. It almost seems as if the government's been hijacked by the energy industry, who are simply using their friends in the government to get them permission to go and extract fossil fuels wherever they feel like it, and also destroy the environment.
Yeah, that is essentially the case. It's
Do they not have children? Do they not think about future generations?
They have children. I think a lot of these people, especially in the case of Lord Howell, his child is the current Chancellor of the Exchequer. So they're probably talking to their children right now because they're MPs.
I brought a little surprise along for you this week
to
look at. This is not the absolute latest edition, but this is a magazine called Strategy and Tactics.
Okay.
And actually, this has been sitting in my cupboard for a few years. It's one of those magazines. I don't know. It's still published. Once every 2 months, it comes out. And you get a magazine about some sort of historical battle somewhere, and also some little counters to play a game. Now, this one I brought along because it's a particularly interesting part of the Second World War. Cobra, it's called, and it's Strategy and Tactics number 85. Patton's 1944 summer offensive
France. Now, this is the bridge too far, isn't it?
It's a little bit before that. It's just after. It's basically in between the Normandy landings and D-Day and the Operation Market Garden, which is the attack, biggest airborne attack in history in Holland. But it includes one of the most interesting battles fought, which was the German defenders of Europe, because they were occupying Europe and we were invading it in 1944, were trying to throw back the Brits and the Americans and the Canadians and the rest back off onto the sea before the Battle of the Bulge. And it's the Falaise Gap Battle. So there was a lot of wrangling going on. The Germans were really trying to make sure that the D-Day landings were unsuccessful. And they actually failed. But you can refight that battle if you want here. And that's one of the things I find fascinating about it. It gives you a bit of historical information. You can go through the history and you can refight these things. Do you think there's any point in this? Oh, am I a complete lunatic for getting the magazine?
Well, I've got a few
like
friends who play Warhammer, so I'm pretty sure they'd be quite interested in this.
Well, isn't that some sort of fantasy thing?
It is. It's effectively fighting fantasy wars and fantasy battles with elves and orcs and stuff, so this is something similar.
I suppose it's actually just as childish as fighting real battles, really.
There we are.
All right, Jason, thanks very much for joining us again. See you next week.
Thank you, Tony. See you next week. Bristol Community FM
93.2. Staying with the news, I'm joined by Anissa Mirra again. Hi and welcome to Dialect, Anissa.
Hello.
Right, what's your subject this week?
Basically, it's about hidden meanings, sort of basically what we are either oblivious to or we just don't want to know or see, all the inappropriate language, sexual references these days.
Okay, so this is really symbolism that we're seeing in a lot of films.
Yeah, definitely.
Feature films, cartoons. Even sometimes, I suppose, factual documentaries, some of this might be included. It's really called, as I understand it, it's called the study of semiotics. Semiotics is the study of symbolism. So there is a sort of, you can buy books on this stuff, but it's about hidden meanings, hidden within cartoons and that sort of thing. So can you describe the sort of thing you're talking about? What do you mean by hidden meanings?
Sort of like things that sort of we don't pay attention to, like a lot of us watch TV or read the magazine, sort of an escapism, isn't it, really? For us to sort of just hide away or just have a laugh. And there's a lot of really inappropriate or just rude languages or references that I've started to realise these days, and I'm really shocked by it.
Like, this is about noticing things that maybe other people aren't noticing. What my granddad used to call eyes and no eyes, Tony. Some people will see these things, other people won't. So can you just separate out for us what you mean by this in terms of the language that's used and the actual symbols that you see visually, you know, pictures?
Well, picture-based, there's a lot of, within music, there's a lot. You see either Lady Gaga or Beyonce, Rihanna wearing or protesting sort of really inappropriate clothing, and like you see the shops selling them or sort of similar, like be like your favorite celebrity. And there's so many young girls nowadays that dress so inappropriately or just feel like they have the right to act in a certain way just because people higher up are doing it.
So you think that the sort of inappropriate clothing that some of these pop stars and icons are wearing actually affects the minds of the younger kids?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, I don't think I don't think themselves even realise it, or their parents do, but even the lyrics as well along with that.
Okay, so what have you yourself noticed?
I'm a huge fan of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and someone recently ruined it for me and said, basically, if you think about it, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs are they imitate seven symptoms of drug use, such as dizziness and the tiredness and the one that's always jumping around and energetic. And once you look into it, you realise it. And maybe it could be just people's perceptions just building up and the word goes out, but I do believe it, and I think there are certain things that you don't realise, or like disco songs when you were young. Me and my friends were going through the lyrics, and they were quite harsh, and I was like, I sing them in my room and stuff when I was young, and I didn't realise.
Well, I mean, some of that, I know it sounds silly, but some actual nursery rhymes are quite horrid as well, aren't they? The things that little children sing, like that "Ring a Ring of Roses," is supposed to be about the plague and people dying of the plague. So, do you think that this has a really negative effect, or is it a bit sublime and it float over the heads of children?
I think majority of it probably just floats over the heads, but deep down, I think it does have an effect. There was a documentary in America, and basically those children who sort of play Xbox games and fighting games, and they basically showed pictures of people who'd passed away in the war, those kids that play the games, and they weren't really fazed by their emotions weren't fazed by it because they're so used to it, but the people that didn't play the game and were shown it horrified.
That's right. I think certainly the video games industry is far too closely connected to the military. They seem to almost use it as a recruiting tool to soften people up. Okay, so what difference would it make if you personally stopped listening to music with this inappropriate language and sexual references then?
I think obviously it would make me act a bit differently and obviously be more aware. But I think personally, on a wider scale, it wouldn't do much, really. Obviously, personally to me, I would stop listening to it and I would have a bigger perspective of things. But for everyone else, they're still involved in it. So
yeah, so it's very difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially to look at the ratings of a film to see whether it's appropriate for children, not to know. I mean, you were talking about The Simpsons before we came on the air. What do you make of that? Because apparently that is actually an adult cartoon and shouldn't really be shown to children.
It is. I found that out a few years ago, and I'm 20 now.
But why is that?
I don't know. I think it was... There is a lot of sexual references in within it, and there's a lot of violence. Like, they have Halloween, or like the Halloween, sometimes their episodes were a lot of killing and stuff like that. The parents, obviously, them being a happily married couple, had sort of innuendos and sexual references going between those two. And obviously, when young, you don't realize it because you're just focused on the pictures. That's what it is, like the bright images and stuff. So,
well, maybe one of the answers might be to look at getting DVDs for the children from series from the 1970s, maybe, where actually it was a little bit stricter and these kind of images weren't in them.
Yeah, definitely. I think with young minds, obviously, they're more, they're like sponge, aren't they? They absorb everything. So imagine someone reading or listening or watching a load of things that are really inappropriate. Obviously, would have a huge effect on them when they get older.
Okay, Anissa Mira, I don't think it's the last we're going to hear on this subject. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
How many people living together does it take to make a fully self-sustaining modern community? Well, there's enough specialists to deliver modern civilised needs and comforts such as health, education, water and power, transport and agriculture. Well, could such a community be entirely self-sustaining, not making everything itself, but having surpluses that they could use to trade and barter with the outside world for what they couldn't make themselves? These are the questions that gripped two people with Bristol connections, both of whom found themselves over at the Centre for Alternative Technology at Macunclith in Wales back in the early 1990s. One was the director of the Schumacher Society, Richard St. George, who sadly died last year. So as a tribute to Richard and his work, here is his colleague, former director of Solon South West Housing and the Centre for Alternative Technologies director, Roger Kelly, at the time. He describes their plan, which ended up being called Ecoville 2000, because it looked like they would only be able to build this state-of-the-art eco-village community in France. So here's Roger talking about Richard and his Ecoville 2000 at the Somerset Big Green Gathering back in the summer of 2007. And here he's talking about the various sites that they looked at over in France.
So we went and looked at a variety of different sites. First of all, down in Provence, which is beautiful, of course. And we did see some very interesting sites, but all of them had something that was slightly odd about them. One of them was certainly an ex-military base, and somewhere on the edge there were still bunkers with nuclear missiles in them, something like that. And another one was a beautiful bit of land, right on the edge of a big lake, but it had a very high voltage power line cutting right across the middle of the site. So, you know, we were looking at one site after another and saying, yeah, this is good, but it doesn't really seem to work. And this was with, I mean, you know, government in France is fairly decentralised, so this was with provincial government officials down in Provence, and they were a bit miffed at the fact that all these sites they'd turned up for us. We didn't think any of them were particularly suitable. But anyway, we went back to the central government people, and they passed us on to their counterparts in a neighbouring region called Lozère, which very few people have ever heard of. It's one of these wonderful hidden bits of France that has almost no tourism in it at all. But if you go there, I mean, it's just amazing. It's a fantastic landscape. It's actually right on the southern edge of the Massif Central. So it's very high, and it's just before the land basically slopes down towards the Mediterranean. And that southern part of the Massif Central is basically a limestone plateau. It's a bit like around here, actually. So you've got this very porous limestone structure. All the rainwater drains straight through it. You don't get any rivers up on the plateau. The rainwater cuts through it and then carves over millions of years these amazing gorges, like the Cheddar Gorge, exactly the same thing. So you've got this incredible contrast between this fairly bleak landscape on the top with no water, no running water up there at all, and then these deep gorges with incredible fast-flowing rivers along the bottom and very steeply terraced growing land on either side of the river. So we went and looked at a few sites in this area, and eventually we were shown one that seemed to click. Everything seemed to be fitting together. It was one big piece of land, about 850 hectares, which is a hell of a lot of land, that's about 2,000 acres, all owned by one man, which helps, because a lot of the other land we looked at was owned by dozens of different people. And he had actually just put it on the open market. He wanted to sell it. That was one of these sort of typically French stories in a way. He was running these 850 hectares of land as a, a wild boar hunting reserve. So, I mean, basically the landscape up there is open. There are no fences. There are no land boundaries. It's mostly sheep farming country. And the sheep just roam everywhere. But obviously, if he was going to keep wild boar, he had to fence to keep the wild boar in, and to keep people out as well. So he actually built this, must be about a 3-metre-high chain link fence around 850 hectares of land, if you can imagine. So anyway, we talked to him and told him what we were proposing, and he said, fine. We told him we had to do this feasibility study, which the French government were paying for, and it was going to take quite a lot of time, at least a year, maybe 18 months. And he said, fine, go ahead, just keep me in touch with what's going on. So that's what we did. We spent 18 months doing the feasibility study. It was one hell of a lot of work, and I'll sort of go through a bit of it a bit later on. And at the end of it, we had to put it all together. We had to have the whole thing, it was about 200 pages, translated into French, with all the diagrams and everything else. And then we had to give a presentation of it to serried ranks of government officials in the sort of regional government offices. And that was pretty grueling.
Former director of the Centre for Alternative Technology in Wales there, Roger Kelly, talking about plans put together back in the early 1990s with Richard St George for a giant self-sustaining eco-village. And this broadcast is a tribute to Richard, the director of Bristol's Create Centre-based Schumacher Society, who sadly died last year. And there'll be more from Roger in coming weeks.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
It's time for the What's On, Jeff Sparks.
Hello, this is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting on Friday, 23rd of August, 999 will be performing with support from Shack 42, The Red Tears and Discord at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7pm. Also on 23rd of August, The Vibrators will be performing as part of Ciderbolt, which is a cider and music festival at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 7.30pm. Into Song of the Week, I present The Wurzels. This group formed in 1966 as Adge Cutler and The Wurzels, and after Cutler's death in 1974, they renamed themselves The Wurzels. They are still performing and recording these days, and this is a song from the album A Load More Bullocks, which was released in 2010, and is a cover of Kaiser Chiefs' song Ruby.
Go! We'll be right back. today. 'Cause there's only OLs occupying my head. There is nothing I need except the function to breathe. But I'm not really fussed, doesn't matter to me. Ruby, 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 Ruby! Do you, do you, do you, do you? What you doing, doing to me? Let the clocks be reset and the pendulums held. 'Cause there's nothing at all except the space in between. Finding out what you called and repeating your name. Ruby, 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 Ruby! Do you, do you, do you, do you? What you doing, doing to me? Could it be that you're only joking with me and you don't really see you with me? Could it be that you're joking with me all the time and you don't really see you with me at all?
Great stuff.
Ruby, 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 Ruby! Do you, do you, do you, do you? What you doing, doing to me?
Fantastic West Country take on a pop song there from the Kaiser Chiefs. Thanks very much for that, Jeff. That was immense. Can we have some more of the Wurzels in the forthcoming weeks? Because they really are able to spice up on West Country eyes some of these boring old pop songs, highly polished, highly produced, into something a little bit more grassroots, aren't they?
Oh, definitely. And yeah, we're going to be playing a lot more Wurzels over the next few weeks, definitely. Anyway, carrying on, that was The Wurzels with Ruby, which was originally by Kaiser Chiefs. For more information on The Wurzels, you can check out www.thewurzels.com. Into Saturday, 24th of August, Kay Passa will be performing with support from Flash Harry and Mr. T and his Minions as part of Ciderbolt, which is a cider music festival at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 25th of August, Smokey Bastard will be performing with support from The Devil's Rejects, The Visceral Thrills and Oscar Everard as part of Ciderbolt, which is a cider music festival at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's studio guests, that's Caroline and Joe Thomas, both from the Bristol Animal Rights Collective, that's BARC for short. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's 989 7733. And you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
This is from the old school, new school.